We'll move right into the Hanson case. Oh, did you used all your time, right? You didn't have any, well, that was my recollection. Thank you. Why don't you all change tables, if you will? Justice Coates is not going to be able to sit with us through this next argument. He'll review the tapes, and he will be participating in this case. So, this next case is Hanson versus the Colorado Department of Motor Vehicles. It's 2012 SC 788, set for 30 minutes. You have 15 minutes aside. If you could introduce yourself, please, to the court. So, you're Mr. Carrington. Thanks. And for the defendant, Mr. Sullivan.
Grant Sullivan, Your Honor, if you're arguing for the Department of Justice.
Okay. Graham's actually nicer than we thought it would be, so yeah. Please speak up. Go ahead, if you will, Mr. Carrington.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. My name is Chris Carrington. I'm here on behalf.
You know that podium goes up.
You can look at the thing on the side.
Oh, I'm good.
Over on the right hand side there. There's a button.
Oh, the volume.
No. You raise the podium. No.
There's some arrow buttons if you just on the forward side.
You're showing.
That's all right.
Do you need me to? Can you not hear me?
It's better.
It would be better.
Especially with the noise.
There you go. Thank you.
Yeah.
Fancy. Thank you.
It's like the coolest part of the courtroom.
Yeah, we like to show that off.
Thank you, Your Honor.
As I said, may it please the court. My name is Chris Carrington. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Hanson. And I want to focus my discussion to application of the exclusionary rule in a license revocation proceeding. In layman's terms, the exclusionary rule says, officers, if you go into that house, you will get no benefit from it. If it's a bad contact and going to that house, we'll get no benefit from it. The state urges a result that says, if you go into that house, you'll get some benefit from it. You won't get the criminal conviction, but you'll get a decent consolation prize, you'll get the loss. That is essentially the kind of the threshold or fundamental question, really, that the court must decide in applying the exclusionary rule. And to Your Honor's point in the other case, whether or not we have to get there. The statute is not really that clear. It says that it shall be considered, the new statute. It says it shall be considered, and I don't know what that means. I think it means that the DMV can say, well, we considered it. Thank you very much. Have a nice day. Because it doesn't say the consequence of that consideration. One way the court could say that bad stops, that unlawfully obtained evidence is not admissible without getting to the exclusionary rule, this is the way that Peterson Tipton did it in Wallace. And those courts said, because probable cause was used by the legislature in the express consent statute, then we have to, then that necessarily implicates and includes reasonable suspicion of other Fourth Amendment principles. So Peterson Tipton said, if there is not probable cause, and that probable cause has to be based on lawfully obtained evidence, then you don't get to, in the DMV has met its, the elements of the revocation. Short of that, I don't know how, with this new statute, that we can divine the intent of the legislature with the way that they've phrased it. For that reason, I want to focus on the application of the exclusionary rule. So I think that it does apply, and here's why. When determining whether or not the exclusionary rule applies, the courts must engage in a balancing test to determine effect versus societal cost. And there's a framework for that set out in the Ahart case and also in U.S. v. Janus. The framework is, number one, inter-sovereign versus intra-sovereign. Is the entity trying to use the evidence inter-sovereign or intra-sovereign with the entity that collected unlawfully? And then the second piece is it a quasi-criminal proceeding? Starting with inter versus intra-sovereign, the way that the Francine Court of Appeals, or the Francine decision, addressed this point is the same way that the Attorney General presented it today, or the Department presented it today. They said, you have a Littleton police officer who's a city officer, it's a city entity, and they're using the evidence in a DMV of the state. So, it's in our sovereign, that's the end of the analysis. But that can't, I submit that can't be. Because if you just make that sort of superficial level of the analysis, it doesn't hold up. It's not a workable framework. Because what if it was a Colorado State Patrol? Now you have a state entity unlawfully collecting the evidence and a state entity, the DMV, trying to use it. So then you say it's intra-sovereign. So if it is the CSP that pulled over the individual, well, then the exclusionary rule applies, but if it's the little police department, then it does not. So for that reason, it's not workable. The rationale that was set forth by the farmer. Instead, and this is what the U.S. v. Janus Court says, you have to look at the relationship between the offending officer or the offending police agency and the entity seeking to use it. A critical factor is whether or not, and this is in the Janus case, there's some type of agency between the two. Whether or not there's a duty to, a responsibility to, or an agreement with the sovereign trying to use it between that sovereign and the police agency. And here, there is absolutely that agency relationship. The statute, 42.2.126, says in various places that the arresting officer shall, acting on behalf of the department, that's verbatim, acting on behalf of the department shall serve a notice of revocation. Acting on behalf of the department shall issue a temporary permit. And then there's a section that says it shall report this to the DMV. So they have a duty, they have a statutory legal duty to act as an agent of the department in some context with regard to that criminal investigation. The express consent law also requires that the officer who issues the notice must appear if requested. So they have a duty, they have a responsibility, they have legal obligations to the department. Another way of looking at this is the zone of interest test. And that was also set forth in U.S. v. Janus. And the zone of interest test says that if the officer's zone of interest is similar to the entity that's trying to use it, then that leans in favor of an intra-sovereign. So think of it as a Venn diagram. You have a police officer who is responsible for enforcing traffic laws, checking license, registration, insurance, that sort of thing. This is the same zone of interest as the DMV. Admittedly, the officer has other interests, criminal investigation, and those sorts of things, but part of the police officer's interest falls within the zone of the DMV's interest. So that weighs in favor of a finding that it's an intra-sovereign under step one of the AHART analysis. The second step in AHART is a quasi-criminal proceeding. And this is kind of difficult, it's a difficult question, but I think that you can get some guidance from the fact that an express consent revocation springs from a criminal investigation. But for a criminal investigation, a DUI, there's no other way that it comes about. It is an adjunct of a criminal investigation. So is it quasi-criminal? It's closely related to a criminal investigation. And in fact, the statute for DUI is 42.4.1301. The statute for express consent is 42.4.1301. So they are adjacent in the statute. They are adjunct proceedings. The analogy I would make is a forfeiture. A civil forfeiture action is an adjunct of a criminal action. And I believe it was the AR case where that analogy was made. One question that's come up in the briefing is, well, the department is not seeking to punish him. It's strictly for public safety. And their purpose is the safety of all persons on the highway. But the purpose of the criminal code also includes the interest of public protection. So in some respects, to say that it's public safety, one man's public safety is another man's punishment. They're opposite sides, seem to be opposite sides of the same coin, or concurrent justifications for the same result. And in AHART, I believe the opinion stated that the civil termination proceedings indeed exact a punishment because they lose their job. So I would say that here, this is also a quasi-criminal proceeding because it springs forth from a criminal statute and it's so interwoven with the police involvement, they come and they testify. So,
Have we ever said that in the context of driver's licenses?
Have we ever said that?
That it's a quasi-criminal proceeding. The driver's license revocation.
I'm not aware of a case where this court has said that. No, sir. But I think this is a matter of first impression as to applying the AHART factors to license revocation. more broadly, the court must look at deterrence. Think about it this way. The exclusionary rule is calculated to remove any incentive for unlawful behavior by the police officers. So don't we lessen that deterrent effect if they still have some incentive? By putting a license on the table and saying that if you go into Mr. Hansen's house, as they did in this instance, you're not going to get the criminal case, but you'll still get some. So what we've done is we've weakened the exclusionary rule and the purposes behind it by giving some, like I said, a consolation prize in a sense. That was a major concern with the Oregon Supreme Court and the Vermont Supreme Court, both of which decided that the exclusionary rule would apply in driver's license proceedings. The concern was, if we don't apply it, then we tacitly approve officers' ability to stop someone for no reason, based on a hunch or stereotypical beliefs. And what they can do then is say, I'm just stopping you for no reason, and if I detect alcohol or else I think there's something going on there, then an investigation unfolds. They lose the criminal case for the civil license. If they don't detect alcohol, we never hear about it. Neither you nor I, and the citizen goes on their way and whatnot. But the Fourth Amendment has been violated. And that was a concern with the Oregon court. The Pennsylvania Board of Parole case for Scott, the U.S. Supreme Court case, one issue that that case turned on, the officers were investigating a defendant in unlawfully collected evidence. It was later used in a parole hearing. And the Supreme Court said, it's unlikely that officers are going to know when they first come in contact with a defendant whether he's on parole. So it would have very little deterrent effect. That actually moves in favor of my argument, whereas in my case, the officers always going to know that this is going to impact the license proceeding. The state's position also in the brief was that it would require suppression hearings. This was a concern of the U.S. Supreme Court in the parole context. It was a concern in the deportation context, and that's the Lopez case. And the Supreme Court said, wait a minute, so we have to stop the deportation. We have to stop the parole hearings, go find an Article III judge and have a suppression hearing? These proceedings are supposed to be quick and efficient. And indeed, the DMV proceedings are supposed to be quick and efficient. However, the DMV, the statute says, you have to consider these things anyway. So we're already having these hearings. There's no extra burden that's going to be placed on the DMV by requiring that they apply the exclusionary rule.
Counsel, can I stop you here and ask you, what is your position with regard to the new legislation? How does it affect your case, if at all?
It wasn't in place at the time. What I find peculiar about it is that the statute that was in place at the time in my client's case said that you had a probable cause. And Peterson, Tipton, and Wallace came before that and said probable cause means it's a bad contact and you can't do it. Then comes 2010, you have the statute, and then you have the new statute. So my client's case, or my client's statute, is bookended by the same result on both sides. So building on the argument presented earlier, I think that the reasonable inferential step is that the legislature said, we need to clear this up, and we're going to follow Peterson detail. But does the new statute affect my client? I don't think it's retroactive.
Right. I guess your position is that Peterson governed all along.
Peterson applied at the time, in my case. That's right. And here's the deal with Peterson. They were interpreting a statute that included the probable cause language, and that's what turned Peterson. When it came time for my client's case, it also included probable cause. So I don't know why the rationale of Peterson at the time, just because the statute was amended in some fashion, but kept that probable cause language, I think the rationale of Peterson would still apply.
Okay, and then how do you kind of consider the fact that Peterson isn't a Colorado Supreme Court?
That is not?
Yeah, I mean, how does that play in your analysis, if at all?
I think that it's instructive or persuasive. I mean, obviously it's not binding. But at the time, it was the highest court that had looked at the issue.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to say the remaining 2.5 minutes for about.
Sure.
Thank you.
Mr. Sullivan?
Good
May it please the court, I'll try to talk loudly. The Hansen facts differ significantly from the facts of the companion Mancini case. The Hansen facts magnify what this court has termed the, quote, societal cost of applying the exclusionary rule to preclude highly relevant and probative evidence. The record in this case reveals not only that Mr. Hansen was traveling 100 miles per hour when he almost collided with another motorist, but also that when his vehicle swerved to exit the highway, it crashed into a 6x6 highway post, causing injury to Mr. Hansen and damage to his vehicle. No brake marks were found at the crash scene. These public safety concerns support the Court of Appeals decision. First, the Court of Appeals correctly determined that the circumstances of the initial contact are not relevant under the statute then in effect. And second, under this court's Ahart balancing test, the exclusionary rule does not apply in these civil license revocation hearings. Now, I want to turn first to the statutory issue, which we had some questions about in the first argument. There are two main elements of a civil license revocation proceeding. And my colleague, Ms. Smith, went through those earlier. But nowhere in the civil statutes does the plain language even mention the exclusionary rule or indicate that the circumstances of the initial contact are in any way relevant in the civil hearing.
Counsel, can I just stop you there and ask you to respond to your opposing counsel's argument that the statute mentioned probable cause?
Yes, Justice.
And that kind of imports many concepts, at least according to their argument.
Yes, Justice. The plain language of the statute requires the law enforcement officer to have probable cause to believe that the driver was operating a motor vehicle while intoxicated. It says nothing about the initial circumstances of the initial contact. And I think there's a distinction between those two. I think a simple example can illustrate the differences. An example that most of us are all familiar with, speeding. If a law enforcement officer observes a driver speeding, he's going to have reasonable suspicion that a traffic infraction has occurred. But without more, he's not going to have reasonable suspicion or probable cause to believe that intoxication exists. Now let's assume for this hypothetical that the officer was mistaken about the speed limit. He thought you were going 70 and a 55, but in reality, the speed limit was 70. He's now going to lack reasonable suspicion for the speeding violation, but upon approaching the driver's door, he sees all the indicia of intoxication. Watery bloodshot eyes, smelled alcohol in the breath, slurred speech, maybe there's a beer can in the cup holder. The officer is now going to have probable cause to request clinical testing. He has probable cause to believe that there's intoxication, even though the reasonable suspicion for the initial contact, what he thought was speeding, might somehow be invalid. That's not also going to invalidate the probable cause for the intoxication. It's these sorts of circumstances that the General Assembly had in mind when they explicitly put in the statute, the disposition of any criminal charges shall not affect the civil license revocation.
But counsel, under your scenario, in the criminal context, the invalidity of the initial stop would invalidate the probable cause. I mean, the fruits of that arrest would be excluded under the exclusionary rule, right? So, back to Justice Eye's point, if the statute refers to the concept of probable cause, does that not reflect an intent to sort of import those broader Fourth Amendment principles, including the exclusionary rule, and if not, why not?
No, Justice Marquez, there's no intent to import the criminal protections of the exclusionary rule into the civil statutory scheme. That was Judge Taubman's point in his dissent in the Francine case. He had an implication analysis, and the department just simply disagrees with that. As Judge Boris points out in her majority opinion in Hansen, the term probable cause is regularly used in our civil statutes, and it refers to a quantum and quality of evidence. It's not meant by its terms to import a criminal protection into a civil administrative hearing. It's not an evidentiary rule. It's simply a legal term of art that describes a quantum and quality of evidence. And in the civil statutes when it's used, and I think we cite some 12 or 15 of them in our brief, none of those instances relate to law enforcement officers or the exclusionary rule whatsoever.
So there's plenty of examples of using the term probable cause in civil statutes that have no reference to the exclusionary rule. So because of these public safety concerns that are at issue, the department and the public has a strong interest in making sure that those intoxicated drivers are removed from the public highways, but not necessarily seeing them suffer a criminal conviction as a result. In your hypothetical, Justice Marquez, yes, the evidence might be excluded in a criminal case, and that's fine, because we want to deter policemen from conducting illegal stops, certainly. But the public safety concerns at issue, removing those dangerous drivers from the road, are going to override that in the civil hearing and remove their license for, in the case of a first-time violation, 9 months. And it's only until that driver shows the ability and the necessary knowledge of our traffic laws that he'll regain the privilege to drive. Justice Hobbs was questioning earlier about, is there any holding from this court saying that these hearings are quasi-criminal in nature at all? Quite the opposite. There's plenty of cases from this court, including your Garner decision, Justice Hobbs, where you say driving is a privilege, it's not a right. And for that proposition, you cited the Deutschendorf case, which is more famously known as the John Denver case. And in that case, this court said that the revocation of the privilege to drive is characteristically free of any criminal punitive element. So I think this court has already answered the quasi-criminal question with its holdings in Garner, in Deutschendorf, and others. Back to the statutory issue, we had some questions, I believe, from Justice Boatwright and Justice Hood. What is the purpose of the new House bill's consider language, if not to exclude it? The department's position is that the exclusionary rule does not apply even under the new House bill, the new amendment. And the reason for that is, if you look at AHART, there's some dicta in AHART that says that the exclusionary rule could apply even if you conduct the balancing test and conclude that it doesn't apply generally. In AHART, it was in the parole revocation hearings. In Harfman, it was attorney discipline proceedings. But even if you perform that balancing test and determine that it doesn't apply generally, if there's evidence that the government conduct at issue was in bad faith or shocks the conscience, then in that particular case, the rare case, it could apply. And I think that that's what the General Assembly might have been getting at when they enacted this new statute, saying the hearing officer shall consider the validity of the initial stop. So under AHART, I sometimes refer to it as the AHART safety valve. If we have government conduct that shocks the conscience, the hearing officer can consider that evidence and determine whether or not it's appropriate. Does it shock the conscience? If it does, maybe we'll go ahead and reinstate the license because of the egregious conduct. Justice Marquez, you asked if there was the new House bill, the new amendment, was a clarification of existing law. The department's position is that it's not. It's a change in the law. We presume with amendments that statutes are changed, that they're not really clarified. That's in Title II in the presumptions that we make when we see legislative action. But frankly, even on this court's holdings and Powell and others where we try to discern a test for determining whether or not there is a clarification, the primary thing we always look to is what language did the General Assembly use? Did they use the term clarify? Did they say that they disagree with a prior construction of the law? And in this case, I urge the court to look at the amendment. There is nothing in the text of the amendment that says that it's a mere clarification. So there's nothing that overcomes the presumption of a change in the law. And then Justice Hood, you asked, why are we all here? Does it make sense to decide this case? I think Justice Boatwright had a similar question. What's the utility of deciding in this case, this pair of cases under the old regime? I agree with my colleague. There are a handful of cases where this would be a dispositive question. Certainly the constitutional issue, the AHART issue, is still at issue under either statutory regime. But again, it's our position that the new House bill does not apply to this set of cases, and that we'll have to await a new case that arises after, it's May 11th of last year when the new House rule was enacted. I did want to spend just a couple minutes responding to some of the arguments by Mr. Carrington under the Ahart balancing test. He quotes some of the statutory language under his analysis, suggesting that the law enforcement officer acts on behalf of the department, and that constitutes intra conduct that would support application of the exclusionary rule. I would just point out that under this court's analysis and the Court of Appeals analysis in AEL, the question is, what are these government agencies? Are they the same agency? And if the answer is no, then it's interconduct. We don't ask, is one agency acting on behalf of the other agency? But I would go deeper than that and point out that in these cases, the officer has no discretion. He is acting on behalf of the department, yes, but it's really a ministerial function that he's doing. If there's a refusal, or if the resulting chemical test is higher than the legal limits, he must serve a notice of revocation. There is no discretion that he's acting on behalf of the department. I would also note that...
Counsel, can I just, before you move on to that point, can I ask you just to respond to your opposing counsel's argument that the Colorado State Patrol would be the same sovereign as the department, and we can't base a general rule where it wouldn't work in that instance.
Right, sort of.
That's kind of the gist of the argument.
Right, sort of the state versus state agency versus the state and local agency. Well, I would point out that in these two cases, it's not two state agencies. The law enforcement officer in question in this case was a sheriff's deputy, which is a county-level agency, a local agency, and then the DMV, of course, is a state agency. So even in this case, we have inter-conduct. It's not intra-conduct. But even if it were two state agencies at issue, again, under this court's Ahart test, the AEL decision from the Court of Appeals, I think, is instructive. If there are two separate agencies, that even at the same level, local level and state level, they're two separate agencies that serve different purposes, then it's inter-conduct, not intra-conduct. In the AEL case, which is an interesting case, that was a dependency and neglect case, the Court of Appeals held that the city of Denver was actually a different agency than the Denver police. So I think that there is precedent for saying that even if they are very closely aligned and might communicate with each other, it doesn't amount to intra-conduct. And in Ahart itself, it was the same agency. It was the same government agency that procured the evidence illegally and then tried to introduce it in a later hearing. This court still decided that the exclusionary rule did not apply. Because again, it's a non-dispositive consideration. We look at the overall balancing. What are the societal costs at stake? And in this scenario in particular, where the DMV is charged with the critical task of removing dangerous intoxicated drivers from the public highways, I would suggest that the societal costs are very steep.
Thank you.
Mr. Carrington, I see I'm short on time, just very briefly. Mr. Carrington suggested that the deterrent effects could still be gained by applying the exclusionary rule in these civil license revocation hearings, because otherwise we would have law enforcement officers just willy-nilly going around serving notices of revocation when they don't have reasonable suspicion for this stop. I would urge the court to look at the Hudson versus Michigan case from the U.S. Supreme Court. In that case, which is a criminal case for a violation of the knock and announce rule, Justice Scalia goes through all the different types of deterrents that we have besides the exclusionary rule. He talks about how there are internal affairs investigations, how we have officer discipline hearings, how there's potential civil liability under a 1983 claim. These are all deterrents that deter our now, quote, professional police force that we didn't have several years ago when the exclusionary rule was first passed. So the exclusionary rule, I see my time has expired.
Thank you very much. I think you have a few minutes left, Mr. Carrington. 2 minutes, 29 seconds.
Thank you. I just want to touch on 3 points.
Sure.
Number one, the term probable cause is not merely a quantity of evidence. I don't think it's an idle, those were not idle words chosen by the legislature. The term probable cause can be found verbatim in Article 2, Section 7 of the Colorado Constitution, as well as in the Fourth Amendment. And I think that when the legislature used that term, they meant cause based on evidence lawfully obtained. Number two, there's been some talk of a distinction between driving as a privilege and not a right. And while that is what the case law has held, the overwhelming concern is not the driving privilege or right, but it's whether or not officers can go into Mr. Hansen's home and still get some benefit from that evidence. So the right is the Fourth Amendment right that brings us here today. And then finally, Your Honors, Mr. Sullivan spoke about the fact that it was an egregious case that Mr. Hansen was behaving egregiously. But keep in mind that this is a fairly egregious case on both ends. We have an officer who gets a ready report, gets a license plate number, goes to the house where it's registered to, barges in the door and says, I want to speak to the guy who owns this vehicle. He doesn't know who's driving the car at the time. He doesn't know anything about the case at that time. So can we stamp our informator upon that type of conduct? This is one of the questions before the court. And then in closing, Your Honor, there's been a lot of talk about it's a high social cost, and there's no doubt that the exclusionary rule, we pay a high cost for that. Criminals go free. But we also get a benefit for it. We get a benefit for what we pay, and that is we are free from governmental intrusion, unreasonable searches and seizures. So under the state's result, we must still pay the high cost of the exclusionary rule, and the criminals go free. But we lose the benefit, because officers can still come into the house and get something for their truck. So, for those reasons, I would ask that you reverse the Court of Appeals decision in this case.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carrington, and also you, Mr. Sullivan. We appreciate your arguments. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:00.